Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Greetings, Slackers. It is a brand new episode of the Slacker Podcast, and it is here for you and for you and for you and for you, because Slackers, you complete me. Thank you for listening to the show. If you're brand new to it, you have about 60 or 70 episodes to go back through, from artists like Serge from Kasabian, Biffy Clyro, Fontaines, Jimmy Eat World, if you're into classical, a little bit of Ludovico Einaudi. Phoebe Bridgers episode is really good. The Phineas episode is really good. A little bit of Bob Geldof in there, Jarvis Cocker, Kurt Vile, Tim Minchin, Action Bronson, Sean Paul. Oh my God, who have I not interviewed? If I haven't interviewed them, they ain't worth shit, man. You can fly back through them on all the podcast platforms that you can go and listen to the Slacker Podcast. There's all up there for you. If you would listen to my new podcast that I started at the start of 2021 to tail end of 2020, it is a 2.5 hour radio style show that is only available on Spotify, and it's all to do with just me finding the best new chill records, mixing it in with some of those old retro feel good ones, and something that'll make you feel fuzzy and warm and beautiful inside. If you're having a particularly stressful time, or you just want to lie back on your recliner out the back of your house while it's sunny and listen to some floaty records and some floaty tunes, then go and listen to Chill the Beats. Chill the Beats. Go and listen to it now. That would be the best thing in the whole wide world. So yeah, thank you so much to everybody who already does listen to Chill the Beats, and you Slackers who've been here from the start. My God, I love you so much. It is time for a brand new episode with Tim Burgess, who's an absolute legend for many, many different reasons. And you will hear me gush about such and tell him why in this brand new episode of the Slacker Podcast in 3, 2, 1. Well, isn't this cozy? Slacker Podcast with Tim Burgess. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. I've got my homesick Irish Memories cup, which is like probably the cheesiest thing that I have, but it holds like two cups of tea in one. So I'm like, you know, I'm ripe. You know, I'm ready for this.
You got tea on the go.
Big time. Yeah, the real heavy shit. You know.
Got my coffee in a, don't know what it is, tankard.
some sort of
as well. It's iced coffee. Nice
iced coffee. All right. Okay. Right. Like as the caffeine courses through our veins, the conversation will start getting a little bit more and sporadic and all over the show. How you doing? How's things? What's going on?
Very good. I've just driven back from Wales this morning, and just been recording some more solo stuff, really. So been doing that for a week, and just listening parties and just settling back at home.
And
just walked through the door.
You were in Rockfield, which is like the famous studio, which had a documentary come out about it a couple of months ago.
That's right. Yeah. It's just there for 8 days, and I don't know. It just feels really great. I mean, there's a long time that we didn't go to Rockfield, or I didn't go to Rockfield. Just reconnected with the place again, really. Not because of the documentary, but because just as you know, things happen, and just felt like it was the right place to go again.
Definitely, like just sort of like revisiting those old characters as well. Because I really enjoyed that documentary, having the family in it and the farmers and stuff. Like, for anybody who hasn't seen the documentary, the farmers that own that land and that studio kind of like are almost like the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth member of each band that comes in, aren't they? They kind of hang about a bit.
Yes, they do. Yeah, I mean their history is incredible. That they, Joe Meek recorded their debut single. They took Joe Meek's kind of tech, which was like recording people in the bathroom and stuff like that, turned that technique into a with their farm, of course, into a residential studio. And they're brothers, they're in their 80s now, so they're kind of quite experienced and about running studios, and they've just kept it going since. Well, however long, I don't know. But they're fun, and they do join in, and they do just pop their head into the studio to see how things are going. They're just very happy that things are going well. And
Do you feel you picked up some of that old school magic that you had when you were making the Charlatans records back there, back in the day?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think so. I think it was important for the Charlatans to have a residential studio. We did our second album there between 10th and 11th, and it took 6 weeks. And I don't remember any of it really, but I do remember. I was really into every Sunday I'd watch Cracker and Band of Gold and Sam Morton and Susan Lynch, who have become like lifelong friends now, were in those shows. So it's kind of like, that's all I can remember from it.
what was the memory blocker of the time? Was it booze? Was it drugs? Was it like, or was it just a mixture of both?
At that time it was,
I feel like if you're going to be in the countryside in Wales, surely like acid would be the big one that you would go to, no?
Definitely, mushrooms and acid at that time, and booze. But you know, booze, it's a weird one. It kind of creeps up on you. We weren't massive drinkers at all. Not really then. Although we have been through drinking phases. It was more kind of like, you know, things that didn't fill you up.
Yeah, true.
things that were quite light on the mind, if you know
what I mean. Do you have to sit down, in the 90s when you were making a lot of records and stuff, and you're like, well, yeah, I think this album's going to be a wine album. I think we're going to drink a lot of wine.
there's definitely a pot album, and that was the fourth album. You can, I, as soon as I put it on, I can sort of like see the, you know, the fugue of sort of smoke, you know.
I love the idea of like you being able to. Well, I mean, it's not uncommon for artists to smoke weed and record songs, but for some it impedes them more than others. I think like there was always this great myth that went around when I was a teenager that, you know, if you smoked weed or whatever, it would heighten your ability to be able to play bass and or guitar or drums, whereas it's kind of the opposite for like 95% of the people, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I can't. Well, it's probably the only time I would pick up the bass and drums would be if I was smoking weed. So definitely allowed me to express myself better on the drums for sure.
Yeah.
not that anybody else was interested.
So one of the things that drummers hate the most at band practice is everybody who thinks they can sort of play has a go on them at some point. The drummer just sits and looks and goes,
everybody wants to play the drums. Everybody wants a go on the drums anyway, you know.
So the start of every podcast, we play a demo. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's your first ever single, Indian Rope. It's a demo that came out a little while ago, I think.
Yeah.
Was it part of a B-side package or something? I'm just trying to find it.
Well, no. Basically, this is...
Oh, it wasn't. It came out this year.
Yeah, it's the 30th anniversary of the Charlatans as people who have recorded records. So 1990, January, Indian Rope came out. So we thought to, you know, mark the 30-year anniversary on the date, we put the demo up and just felt like a good idea. And we were going to do that until, you know, we put out a kind of retrospective box set thing that hasn't seen the light of day yet, because obviously the plans changed quite a lot during COVID and during this year, so we haven't put it out yet. But
you've kept yourself fairly busy though in the meantime. But
I would hate to say I'm too busy, but to come out, but it actually feels like I kind of am at the moment. But anyway,
let's blast this in, right? I'm going to play the version in full, right? And I'll come back off the end of it after, and we'll discuss. Okay.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
What do I think of it now? Yeah. Is that what you said? Sorry.
What images does it conjure up when you?
Well, I mean, we recorded it in somewhere in Kidderminster, which I've never been to before, and I've never been since. And it's just, I don't know. I think John wanted a certain sound on his drums, so and he wasn't getting it. So we ripped the carpet up and we made it like, you know, it was a stone floor, and we made it sound as kind of 60s as we possibly could. Rob was a bit worried about his about the "I Shot the Sheriff" riff, but I think we had, you know, it was made up of a lot of components. Brian Auger, Julie Driscoll and the Trinity, the Beatles, Bob Marley. It was kind of everything all in one song, we thought, you know, and Pink Floyd, maybe early Pink Floyd. And it was 1989, and, you know, everyone had gone kind of like dance. Everyone was like dance crazy, and we wanted to make people dance, and I think it has all those elements, really. Although we changed it a little bit, and some of the lyrics are a bit different on the final version. It sounds amazing to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I love it. Like, and you can definitely feel that like that dance vibe, you know, like, you know, that song, if you had formed the band 5 years later, or sorry, earlier,
yeah,
would have sounded very different.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the bass drum was a lot louder and it was a lot of De La Soul. De La Soul's first album, 3 Feet Higher and Rising, kind of really inspired the drums, really, that, and a lot of dance stuff. Hacienda classics like Dreams of Santa Ana by Orange Lemon, and I think lots of people mention it, but a song called Stuck a Humanoid.
was early hip hop, or like that sort of late 80s hip hop, like prevalent in other places of your music, or was it mainly just sort of drums?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, I suppose hip hop for me, it kind of comes and goes, and I like lots of it. But at that point, I think I was really just listening to Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul, and probably it, you know, introduced a bit early by the Beastie Boys, you know, and their wonderful Paul's Boutique.
Oh my God! Like, and does that? I don't think, like, we can be here in like 3,000 years time as floating heads in like big globules of whatever, right? And we can still very confidently go, the Beastie Boys albums haven't aged; like, they're still fresh.
Well, especially, I mean, you know, I really, really got into Check Your Head and Ill Communication, but Paul's Boutique, you know, is kind of there's something, I don't know, almost unbeatable about that record in a way. Yeah.
Did you ever meet them? Like, I'm sure you would have been playing the same sort of festivals around the same sort of time.
Yeah, I met them a few times actually. Most notably Bremerton, which is in Washington, the Pacific Northwest. We did a festival, and it was Beastie Boys, Sonic Youth, Charlatans, L7, and a few others, and, you know, it was just in 91, and then met them a few times after that in a club called Club Cheetah in Kawasaki, and you know, hung out a little bit. They were very keen on buying Martin's bass, but he didn't want to sell. But yeah, they told us a few secrets about how they got some sounds, and yeah, I'll keep them.
They're good.
But, yeah, great.
Yeah, no, I know. Like, I mean, absolute icons of music. So, like, the Indian Robe track, like, you know, there was a space between Zero and you making that, and I kind of want to sort of examine that for a little bit. Like, was there a big moment in your, like, youth when you were like a kid that you were like, right, this music malarkey is going to be for me? Like, was it a particular, like, a band you've seen on TV, a live performance, a relative in music. What was the sort of catalyst for you?
It all started with Bay City Rollers, really, and Top of the Pops. And then I noticed what an impact that they had on all the kids at the primary school that I was going to. So, and then after that, punk. And if I look back, the style of clothes that Bay City Rollers were wearing and then the Sex Pistols were wearing after that, pretty similar. You know, lots of tartan and sort of spiky hair. And so that was that just was a natural thing. And also, you know, culture was represented quite weekly on Top of the Pops, and there was always kind of a few anomalies to the easy listening that mums and dads liked, with the occasional punk band or something that would resonate with me.
What was it like then when, fast forward to rewind in a second, yeah. But what was it like then when you got on Top of the Pops? Because, did you feel like an outlier on it, or did you feel at home on it?
I felt really good on it. We went on with a song called Then, which was our third single, and also with Weirdo as well. And both those times were just really fantastic. I mean, we went on a few times after that as well, I think Rob went on with a broken arm once, which was quite hilarious. Trying not to give away that miming thing. Just so many great times. I had my photograph taken with the Smurfs, which was pretty amazing. And, we met both Minogues. And so that was kind of, it was just great. But watching Top of the Pops on a weekly basis was just an amazing thing. And one of the best ones ever was seeing New Order do Blue Monday. And that kind of, in many ways, opened up something in my brain, thinking that two members are from Manchester, two members are from Cheshire, where I was growing up. They had a big hit single in Europe. And I just thought, wow, they're so close to home, it can actually really be done, and they're on Top of the Pops, and it's just an amazing thing. And everyone else in the 80s were wearing suits, and New Order were wearing T-shirts, out of their trousers, instead of tucking in, it was out, and it was and they were cool, and they were scallies. And I really really took to that, and it made me feel like I could do it too.
Did you have that same resonation with Joy Division as well, or was it more of a New Order thing?
Not so much, because I mean, I think you very much you Blue Monday and Power Corruption and Lies was my record. It probably always will be in many ways. And I had to backtrack to Joy Division because I wasn't aware of them. I was into kind of second generation punk at that time, Crass and Exploited and things like that. And probably, it was just, I missed that. But I mean, obviously, I've backtracked and have an amazing connection with them now.
Did you spend a lot of time in their club in the Hacienda?
I did, yeah, a lot. I actually went to see quite a few gigs there before sort of committing to going most weekends, and dancing the night away and then walking home. or at least to Altrincham to try and get a train in the at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, on Tuesday. did you ever get to play in it? I can't remember that. Offhand when it shut down, but it was into the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, we played.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what big wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In 93, I remember Hookie being there and some members of The Fall. And it was really beautiful thing for me was that Vinnie Riley took photographs of the sound check. And I tried to, you know, because I'd grown up with Geordie Column, and up certainly from sort of 16 to 22 or 20, however old I was in 94 it would have been then. So I was like about 24, 25 years old then. But and I kind of ran after Vinny and to try and talk to him and tell him how much I loved him, and yeah, he was gone, and I've never seen him since. But.
So those Acid House and those early rave days like were pivotal in like what you would sort of end up doing musically, really, wasn't it? Like, I mean, obviously you didn't go ahead and just make Acid House, but it fed into the energy of what you did with the Charlatans.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was I guess underground, but they're not really that underground, because, you know, there's like Acid House tracks at number one in the charts, you know. But I guess it was, you know, I always felt that I was 11 really when punk was going on, and although I committed to that at the age of 11, no one really sort of said, you know, no one really asked me much about it, you know. I was just like, I like what was on the TV and stuff like that, and watched some shows. But I felt that it was kind of a cultural revolution, really, with Acid House, and I thought, well, I'm going to be right in the center of this. This is like my punk, you know.
Mm. Yeah, totally, and it really was, and it was like as important culturally at the time as punk was. Tell me about. I was fascinated because I've never heard anything from them, but I wanted to know about the Electric Crayons. I'm really obsessed with people's first bands. I love the stories and the naiveties that people have in the first bands. Like, I've got a million like stories of. I almost think sometimes the first band stories are normally the best ones, because you are really going into it from a place of not knowing really nothing and kind of trying to make it up as you go along.
Oh yeah, I mean the Electric Crayons basically played a lot of cover versions, right? There was a couple of Iggy Pop songs, there was a couple of Doors songs. there's a couple of our own, and one that I'm still quite pleased about, and that's the B-side of the actual single. It's called Happy to Be Hated, and I really still like that song. I'll stand by it. Electric Crayons, we played some local shows, really, and we got to play the Boardwalk a few times, and played in, you know, beautiful, you know, clubs around the Northwest, and we put a single out actually on the day that I joined the Charlatans, so it was kind of a bit of a, didn't really work out for, you know.
Sounds like a messy.
My commitment to them.
messy breakup there.
Basically, what happened in between is that we'd recorded this record and we supported the Charlatans, who had a different singer. And Rob and Martin were discussing whether I should be the singer. Now, at that time, I was kind of thinking that I wanted to be Iggy Pop. And so I was when they saw me, I probably didn't have a shirt on, and I was probably wearing leather trousers, or you know,
yeah,
something along those lines, and you know, or pleather trousers, I would imagine, and they kind of they liked me, and they Rob thought I was, you know, going to be the next Jim Morrison,
and there you go, at what point did the band tell you to start putting t-shirts on, or was that a personal decision?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, I went to rehearse with the band, or and it was an audition, but I didn't really know it was an audition. It was just a kind of, I wanted to just sort of like sing and see what happened. And they played an instrumental, and then we went for another song, which was called Always In Mind. Or it later became that, I kind of just did what I knew, which was kind of to do what I kind of did with the Electric Crayons, really, which was, you know, sing like Iggy Pop or Jim Morrison, but it was a bit shouty, and Martin told me to try it again, but next time maybe try singing, and so I kind of like stopped with the kind of like, you know, that, and kind of just chilled a bit, and that is my voice.
Because like people would see you as quite a chilled person now. Like it's like, you know, you've really like you've really fit the glove.
Yeah, I am a chilled person, you know, but you know, I was learning about I don't know. I mean, I just,
it's really hard to chill at that age. Like all young boys have got like that sort of manic,
yeah, and
be in them that they need to get out some way or another. So it sounds like a quite a healthy way of doing it.
Yes, to do it like that.
I was thinking, like, you know, you didn't really like as a bandit, like, you know, you could looking back on it now for me, like you could go, well, like they sound like they could be like, you know, an underground band, or they could be an overground band. It could be anywhere really. But you didn't really spend that long having to toil around the smaller venues, like it kind of like Indian Rope was a bit of an indie hit, and then the second single went top 10.
Yeah, we had a lot of support from Manchester.
How does that happen? Because like thinking about it now, like I mean, I've like run a small label for years, and the idea of me being able to put out a band and get them in the top 10 is so foreign to me. I may as well be trying to launch them onto the fucking moon, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's something going on, wasn't there? I mean, it was like a huge thing. There's like three weekly papers, all wanting content and all wanting to report on the new thing. We had, you know, there's, you know, Stone Roses, Happy Mondays and Spiral Carpets were kind of like, you know, almost like together, kind of like getting a lot of attention, and people were looking for the new thing. And, you know, I remember a Melody Maker came up, Bob Stanley from Melody Maker interviewed Charlatans, Northside, Interstellar, Paris Angels, and that was kind of like supposedly the next wave, you know, the new future of Manchester music. We had a lot of support from Terry Christian, who was, you know, just writing for the Manchester Evening News, and Penny Anderson, who wrote for the NME, and there's a lot of photographers always wanting to photograph us. It was kind of, and then James Brown saw us once. James Brown was the editor of the NME, and he saw us at our London gig, and he put us on the front cover of the NME.
Flipping out, man! Like, did you feel like it moved like at the right speed, at warp speed, at like, did you have to chase your tail, or were you ready for it?
No, it was pretty intense, because this was in between Indian Rope and The Only One I Know. It was, you know, all these things were kind of happening. And then when The Only One I Know came out, we were on tour, and we were driving up and down in the van, and, you know, anytime we put the radio on, we could hear our song on Radio 1, and it was just like nuts. And, it, you know, and every time we turned up, it became really, you know, it was our Beatlemania. You know, it was amazing.
Wow. And like when you have those conversations, when you're like in the band or you're starting out as a band before you're famous, everybody has that idea, like where they're like going, oh, well, like, you know, when we make it, I'm going to like buy my mom a house, or like, you know, when we make it, like, I'm going to like do this, that, or the other. Was there a moment where you were like going, oh shit, like, you know, I can actually buy something lavish, or I can like look back and go, wow, like this is what I was thinking of where I'd be?
Well, I bought a record player, like a really nice record player, so I could play all my records that were all scratched. So, and I've still got a record player, so that's really great. So, yeah, when we got a record deal, that's what I did. But I thought I might have had to buy my auntie a car, because that's all she would go on about. when I get famous, she's got to buy me a car. And it was like, okay. And then I did, and I didn't.
I didn't say what sort of car. You could go buy one of those like battered out stock cars for like 50.
Yeah. Like, I don't think that's what she had in mind.
Auntie, there you go. There's your mini Metro. you were mentioning, like, you know, coming up behind the Inspiral Carpets and the Stone Roses. Like, surely it must have been a lot easier coming up behind them when they sort of took you under their wing, because Stone Roses like got you a support on one of their shows, didn't they, or a couple?
I think it was. Undoubtedly it was, because there wouldn't have been a second wave of Manchester music if there wasn't a first wave. So they definitely made, you know, they definitely forged the way. And I think the most amazing thing was like just how popular British music was abroad, you know. So everywhere we went, it was always about this scene, this thing, you know, all the magazines. It was just like an amazing thing. And I think it was just such an incredible time for British music, really, abroad. It was amazing.
Mm. Like all of the bands that we were sort of mentioning and talking about there, I would say that you, like the Charlatans, and not even yourself, will have released more albums than all of those combined. like you definitely have got like the stay empire, critically and commercially over the years. Like, how come the Charlatans are such a tight-knit group, and you've like managed to continually make great albums over the years while everybody else seems to fall by the wayside?
Crikey.
Or is it just simply that you like enjoy what you do and you don't hate each other?
Well, we don't hate each other, and I don't know whether people have fallen by the wayside or not. I just think that you know, we created our own bubble and our own world, and that's something that we wanted to just roll with, you know. And we've been friendly with other people. We were invited to play with Oasis, you know, and in the same breath we've taken bands on their first American tours and stuff like that. I think that it's just, you know, I think lots of bands are quite good at sharing, you know. There you go. That's yeah. You know, and it's like, I mean, and the amazing thing is that I got to, you know, invite Stephen Morris from New Order to play on the last Charlatans album. I mean, the world of music and the bubble that you create, it just amazes me all the time, you know.
I love the fact that, like, you see artists paying it back and paying it forward. Like, you know, majority of people will realize how difficult it is to get to a certain situation. Then if there's somebody that can do something for you, normally they will. And that goes the whole way up to bands of like The Who, like The Who and like the Stones, who you've supported, but you've also.
Stones. Yeah, exactly. They were great. I mean, Mick Jagger watched our performance from, you know, the side of the stage. And I supported Rolling Stones as a solo on a solo tour, and he came and started doing his warm ups while we were sound checking. It was amazing.
That would really put me off if like Mick Jagger was like peacocking while I was like trying to do my sound check.
Yeah, I didn't think of it like that. I was just kind of like, I was thinking, wow, what a guy, you know. But if I would have thought what you're thinking, I would have probably not been able to sing. But I was just thinking, wow, he's got an eye for everything. You know, he wants to check out everything. You know,
I think there's a level of him that like really appreciates bands like that are doing their thing and doing it well. Yeah. Also, you don't spend as long at the top as he has done without having a healthy amount of like healthy competition. If you like,
an interest in stuff. Yeah, exactly. I think you're right.
Like, do you get that? Like when you bring bands on the road, like does it like spur different things on you when you see other bands playing live?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you know, I love watching how new bands do things. It's a brilliant thing, you know. I mean, part of the reason why I've got a record label is so I can see what, you know, people are doing.
No, I know what you mean. Like, there's a band that like I've worked very closely with over the years. They're like a teenage punk band from Derry called Touts, and Paul Weller took them on tour and would come out and watch them every single night of the tour. And I remember like 4 or 5 nights in, the manager turned to me and was like, Paul has figured out that 2 of the boys had fallen out, even though like he was watching and couldn't understand anything. He came over and was like, are those 2 boys having a thing? And they were like, yeah, because one of the boys didn't turn up for the bus the night before and went AWOL. And it was just like, it's just the little things of like, you know, the understanding the dynamic of people in bands and stuff. It's quite difficult to explain what it's like to be in a touring band, because it's not quite family and it's not quite a stag do, but it's somewhere in between.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't really know what to say to that. I think firstly I was thinking about Paul Weller, and you know, just I don't know. I mean, he does so much for young bands. Secondly, yeah, you're right. It is a family. Our band is very much, you know, we're very supportive of each other, but you know, at the same time, it's just, yeah, it can be dysfunctional, very, you know, all the time, in fact.
It's never easy, is it? Like, it's never just as easy as like, well, we just like write some songs and put them out.
Because missing the bus, you would think, well, what is wrong with that, you know? Yeah. But when it's so concentrated and all you've just been told after the gig, you've got to get on the bus to go to the next gig, it's just the most important thing in the world.
Yeah, because you're not just holding yourself up, you're holding everybody up.
Yeah, and I've dealt with that.
Have you missed the bus before?
No, but I've been in a band with someone who always misses the bus.
do you still play with them?
Yeah.
The
Allisons.
Who is it?
I'll let people guess.
Right, fair enough. I'd say like people will be able to make their own mind up. You were talking about setting up a label. That was like about start of, was that 2010? Run.
Yeah, it's about that. A lot happened for me in 2010. I came back to London and just started again, really, in lots of ways. Lived in Los Angeles for 12 years. Moved back to London, just felt that the time was right, and actually started a label, wrote a solo album, and wrote a book about the same time, really.
What was it like in LA for like those 12 years? Did you have like, did you make your own sort of like scene? Did you have like an enjoyable time in LA?
Yeah, I mean, the first two bands I saw, and they were within a couple of days of each other, was Elliot Smith, that was at the Roxy, and then at the Troubadour I saw Brian Jones and Sam Massacre. So this was like 1998, and I moved there fully in 1999. You know, just everybody comes to play in LA. So I'd go to a lot of shows. I enjoyed the sunshine. Just had a life there, you know, for 12 years. The last couple of years were a bit, you know, I was hopping around from, you know, east to west coast and back to London again, and just finally settled on that London was where I needed to be.
Was it like difficult reacclimatizing? Because obviously you're like a northern boy as well. Like you've been away for a long
time. Yeah, but I've been away for a long time, and I did get cold.
Who was like the? Normally a label is set up more to facilitate the release of one record rather than go, let's just set up a label. Was that your case as well?
There's a couple of people who really thought, I really like their music. And one was a band called Electricity in Our Homes. And another artist was called Joseph Coward. And I thought they were both London based artists. And I really liked their music. It was kind of quite, it reminded me of the sort of things that I was listening to when I was a teenager, really. And it just occurred to me, and some friends of mine, that it'd be good if I could pass on some of my knowledge and you know, some do's and some don'ts, obviously without getting in the way of their vision, but some do's and some don'ts of what could happen and things like that. And I don't want to put their records out, so I believed in them. So they were the first two releases.
Like,
two singles, yeah.
As someone who like has released like about, I don't know, about 15 releases on my label at this stage, it's incredibly rewarding, but probably as much rewarding as it is a massive ball ache, because there's so much. I've met loads of people who go, I'm going to set up my own label. I'm like going, you only can do it if you realize that there's actually like loads of like boring admin stuff that you have to do in the background that nobody ever tells you about.
The metadata stuff, it just kind of like, it kind of drives me crackers, but then sometimes, you know, I need that kind of distance, you know, from say doing the listening parties or being in the Charlatans or trying to write, actually filling in a spreadsheet, actually kind of it just makes me feel like not me.
Yeah, you know? that's like that's almost like reverse escapism when you've spent your life.
It is exactly that.
It is, yeah. It's like most people who work in clerical jobs like dream of being a rock star, and now you're a rock star dreaming of wanting to be in a clerical job. So, I mean, it just goes to show you the grass is always greener on both sides, right?
I mean, that's true. That's true. But it is.
So, like, the you were mentioning the Twitter listening parties. Like, I mean, like, what number are you up to now?
530. Something like that.
How long has it been going for?
Since March. Since the beginning of lockdown.
You've done 530 since the beginning of lockdown. I thought it was going before lockdown. I thought it had been going for like 10 years or something. I thought I just missed out on it.
No, it's not been going very long. I've just done it a lot.
Oh my God. There's probably justice in saying that... that you have helped a lot of people, like not only the artists that are talking about the albums, but people who are fans of them. Like, I mean, I would imagine somewhere like Six Music or Radio One or Beats or somebody. There's a lot of organizations out there probably looking at your thing going, I wish we had thought of this.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I thought about it a long time ago. I saw Riz Ahmed from, you know, actor.
Yeah.
Talking about, he invited everyone to watch Four Lions, and he would tweet about, this is take three. This is the take where I didn't laugh as much as I did in take one and take two. When I get into the car, and I just thought, oh, that's interesting. And I just watched him, and he was like tweeting along with the film. And I thought, I'm going to do that with the Charlatans record. So I ended up doing all of the Charlatans records, all my solo albums, and then all of them again and again and again. And people loved them, right?
Yeah.
When lockdown happened, I decided to start at the beginning again. Some friendly, who's up for it? Lots of people said, yeah, can't wait. Alex Kapranos said, oh, I love that album. And at that moment, it occurred to me that he should do one. And then Dave Rowntree saw that and he said, I'll do one as well. And within, you know, Bonehead.
Has it got out of control?
It did get out of control. It's now back in control because I've managed to, you know, there's some people helping me with the admin and stuff now. But at first, it was all written down on pieces of paper. And I thought, yeah, no one's got, there's not a listening party on the 5th, so someone can go there. And then the next day, it was like, there's not a listening party on the 5th. I put that, and, you know, there's obviously like 10 people all walked in at the same time, yeah. You know, because hundreds of people just got in touch with me.
Wow. I mean, you must have experienced quite a lot of stuff around that. Like, I mean, is there any like particularly mental moments from the listening parties that have like either drastic revelations or something crazy has happened?
I mean, you know, I just mentioned Bonehead then. I mean, you know, Liam mentioned that he would join in a lot, and that kind of brought, you know, and then he didn't, and it was kind of like, then he would say, you know, oh, I think you're doing fine as you are, so I didn't want to join in. And then, of course, he did his own listening party, which was amazing, you know. And, yeah. I think, you know, the Kylie one last week was pretty hectic. But you know, they've all been amazing. They've all been incredible for people who've been, you know, looking for something during lockdown, and they've given people a lot of pleasure, and they've helped me as well, because it just meant that I had something to occupy my mind during something that I found difficult. So.
I understand. Like, I understand where you come from. Like, I think, like, if you are prone to a nervous twitch from sitting around doing nothing, then you will find something to do. And sometimes that thing that you'll find to do is maybe a little bit different than you ever thought you would be doing. I mean, like, I started, like, me and a friend started writing sketch comedy just because we were bored in March.
Wow.
And just kept doing it. Like, we're just doing it because, like, it's creative, it's fun, it's keeping us busy, and it keeps us connecting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's it. The connection is obviously what people don't have when you're on a lockdown. It's found a way, you know.
What do you miss the most right now? Because we record this. Like, this won't be going out for a couple of weeks yet. We recorded this on the 19th of November, mid-lockdown. I miss a pint of Guinness from a pub. Just one pint of Guinness from a pub. I haven't had one in a year.
I actually just like the idea of sort of meeting people, because I don't live in London anymore. So when I go to London, I always have 10 people who I'm going to meet I really miss that, of course. Yeah, that's it. Coffee with friends who stimulate my brain.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, totally. But we'll be back there soon enough. Like, it's just around the corner. Trust me, dude. I've taken up way too much of your time as it is. I'm sure there's been about 6 listening parties that have probably happened in the time.
I think there's a few emails that have come in, but there isn't any. Well, yes, there is, because yes, you're right.
On behalf of your fans of the various different projects that you work on, I thank you for your infinite amount of entertainment to keep everybody happy and smiling.
Oh man, pleasure, and thanks so much for this, Phil. It's great.
No sweat. Thanks for coming on.